If you weren't born with a trust fund, but feel like you should have one, you are in the right place. Welcome to Old Money, a podcast dedicated to breaking down the new rules to living well and getting wealthy. I want you to build a life and a legacy that feels rich in every sense of the word. And while I don't have any insider trading secrets, I do have some secrets about how getting rich is actually an inside job. I'm your host, Amber Evenson. Now, let's get into it. Hello, rich girls. If you played the Powerball this last weekend and you were dreaming of living big, congratulations, I have a better way for you to get rich. Welcome to this week's episode. Welcome back. It's the Old Money Podcast, the only show helping you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. And I am your host, Amber Evenson. Oh my God, I almost said Frank Huzen. My bad. Welcome back. I am so excited to chat with you today because we're going to go all over the place, but we're going to talk about something very specific that you are asking me for. And how do I know what you're asking me for? Well, because it's that time of year, in addition to football season, pumpkin spice latte season, back to school season, it is also Old Money listener survey season. So there is a link in the show notes for you to go and complete a listener survey to tell me a little bit about who you are and what you want to hear. And some of you have already filled out the survey. And this is an immediate reaction to that because I was so excited to see in one of the questions, which are, what are your two financial goals? Overwhelmingly, so far, that is, the top two financial goals are investing, long-term and short-term, and retirement. Now, in the rest of the survey, there's a bunch of other questions like, how do you listen? Do you want video? If you do, you're gonna have to go vote for it in the Old Money Listener Survey. I mean, it's probably coming soon anyway, so just get ready. But anyway, I was really excited to see that that was an overwhelming response from our listeners so far, because that's what I care about too. I mean, the reality is we've spent a lot of time on the foundations, and the foundations are things that we can always be working on, always improving. And what do I mean by foundations? Well, number one, the mindset. That is the foundation of everything that we talk about. And there are so many components to that. Of course, I cover them all in our new course that just launched, Old Money Mindset. We are starting live calls this week. If you have not yet joined, but you're interested, you can still join. There's a link in my Instagram bio. There's a link. Well, I'll put the link in the show notes. I think that's going to be the new take a shot thing. I mean, if you're an OG listener, you're going to remember that, but like take a shot every time I say the link is in the show notes, but it is for Old Money Mindset. And this is the course. This is the answer. This is the information. This is the reprogramming, the tools, the support that I have used to completely upgrade my mindset. And if you're the type of person who has been in the same financial cycles for years, never getting ahead, living paycheck to paycheck, or maybe the same relationship cycles, having the same fight with your partner all the time, or dating the same guy, or having a terrible boss, getting a new job, and still having a terrible time at work, this course is for you. The reason that mindset is so important is because it sets the foundation for everything else that you do with money. So in this course, we're going through and clearing all those financial blocks, clearing all those relationship blocks. I'm talking about the neuroscience, the psychology, the actual practical tools, so that managing your money, spacing your money, organizing your money, being with your money, holding more money becomes easy for you. If you've ever experienced dysregulation with your money, meaning that it makes you feel anxious, it makes you not want to look at it, makes you want to run and put your head in the sand and just hope everything will work out, or if you were banking on winning that Powerball this weekend to solve all of your problems, this is the course that I want you in. This is going to be the level one course. The level two course for Old Money is going to be Machine. And in Machine, I'm going to take you behind the scenes of my money machine that works for me with literally zero effort to continue to build my wealth while I just live my life. And that's part of what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to give you a little preview to the whole investing side of things. But again, Old Money Mindset, link is available for you to still register in the show notes. And we're going to start live calls this week where I'm going to teach on three additional pieces that I think are going to be so valuable. And I would love for you to join us. But why do I keep harping on mindset? Because there actually is a formula to get wealthy, and mindset is the first and most important. What's layered on top of that, if you think of this like a pyramid, mindset is the bottom of the pyramid. It is the base, it's the foundation, it's the thing that's going to set everything on top of it to be level and solid ground. Because if you have a broken foundation, if you have a mindset that doesn't support you holding massive amounts of wealth or leading a team of multiple people, raising your prices, risking more into investments or investing into new companies or ideas, if that foundation is not solid, all your pyramid's going to fall over. It's just going to crumble. You've got to build the pyramid at the bottom first to make sure that your foundation is laid and set and is as solid as the pyramids in Egypt. The next level above the mindset is all about spending control. Controlling your spending is actually so important. And it's that second layer, because if you don't control your spending and you're in debt or you don't live within your means, how are you ever going to get to the higher rungs of the pyramid, so to speak, which include saving more, earning and creating more value, investing and multiplying your wealth, and then protecting that wealth? If you're not keeping wealth every single month, then you don't have anything to invest. You don't have anything to multiply. You know, this last weekend, I was looking for something new to read on Kindle, and I came across an old book that I had downloaded that I haven't visited in a while, and it's called The Richest Man in Babylon. And I actually don't even know who wrote this story or why they wrote the story or when it was written. But essentially, it's an allegory. And the allegory is there's these two men that live in the richest city in the world, Babylon. And they are, one of them is a musician, one of them builds chariots, and they're tired of working. The chariot guy is looking at this unfinished chariot. The musician comes by and is chirping the chariot guy. He's like, "Why aren't you finishing your chariot? You should be making money." And the chariot guy says, "I don't want to work anymore. I'm tired. I'm getting old. I wish I could be rich like the richest man in Babylon." So they go and talk to the richest man in Babylon, and the richest man in Babylon tells them and all their friends in a group of 100 people, "I am the richest man in Babylon because I followed these 7 principles." And you know how when you read something when you're younger, there's like one or two things that you remember from it? Like, I was a huge Cliff's Notes reader all through high school and college. Like, no, I didn't actually read The Great Gatsby. No, I didn't actually read Romeo and Juliet. I get the gist. Like, I'm not a big literature girl. I'm a rom-com or a murder type of girl. But Richest Man in Babylon is a book that I read a long time ago. And the one line that I remember from this book is that first principle, which is, "A part of all I make is mine to keep. A part of all I make is mine to keep. A part of all I make is mine to keep. A part of all I make is mine to keep." And what he tells these guys is to set aside 10% of their income and keep it for themselves. Because if you get, let's say, 10 coins, because you're living back in the day in Babylon, and of those 10 coins, you give a couple away for a new pair of leather sandals, you give a couple of coins away for a new toga, you give a couple away for a ride on a chariot, aka Uber back in the day, and all of a sudden you've given away all of your 10 coins, you have nothing that you made. So he, first principle here, and this is the second step of the pyramid of getting rich, the formula, is to control your spending, to just set some money aside so that you keep it. And he says to do 10% or one of the 10 coins, that's his actual recommendation, to set aside and just make sure that it automatically funnels off, and then you'll never really miss it, and you just start to stash some money away. And of course, he says it's great to do because you get to hear the little coins jingle in your coin purse, and that makes you feel really good. And then you start to see your bounty grow, and all of a sudden, you're feeling really proud of yourself. You're like, "Yeah, I'm doing it." But you really don't start to get rich until you actually put that money to work. So that's what we're going to examine today: why we're not investing and how to get over that inertia to get some momentum and start to go on this journey. Because if you are listening to this podcast, you know I'm not preaching skip your lattes, no more matcha. I'm saying let's get to work, girls, because you are never going to get wealthy unless you start earning more. You start really earning more. And part of earning more is putting the money that you have to work to earn on its own. If you haven't yet listened to my episode with Mira Katz, where we talk about women and men and power and money and how we're different, It's such a good episode. I was listening back to it and I'm like, damn, we went there. And we're really exploring some of the differences between the genders and how we act with money and with business. And something that came up in our conversation is that typically in business or in relationship dynamics, men are seeking power, dominance, they're seeking admiration, they're seeking success, where women are seeking safety, security, and the means of getting that is through control. Because think of it, if you can predict the future, if you know the outcome, if you feel really safe, it's probably because you've been there before, you know what to do. And that can make you feel safe, but it's actually a protector part. That control is a protector part that is protecting something inside of you from being really, really vulnerable. And something we go through in Old Money Mindset, so if that framework doesn't make sense yet, go to the course, I'll explain it all there. Control is actually a subversive type of behavior that gives us the illusion of safety without giving us the results that we actually want. And similarly to that, perfectionism is in the exact same vein. Perfectionism is another protector part. And we often think that if we're perfect, we do exactly what we're supposed to do. We behave ourselves. We get good grades. We get the right job. We don't ruffle any feathers. We do everything right. We respond to every email. If we're perfect, that's going to get us the money, the safety, the security that we want. And the reality is those things are illusions because that is you existing in a vacuum. We live in the real world. And outside of the four walls of my office or your bedroom or your car, wherever you're listening to this, the market is ripping. Last week, the S&P 500 hit a record high that it's never hit before. We're currently living through one of the most volatile times as it relates to our economy and the executive branch that I can remember. I mean, if you don't remember back to 2020, also very volatile. I mean, like, we're just going through it. And so let me ask you, how much do you think the market cares about your perfectionism? What are you going to control in the S&P 500? All that we can control is our reaction and our strategy and our emotions. So if we're getting all emotional about the stocks and the stocks have no emotions about us, we're wasting a lot of energy just draining it, trying to control things, trying to be perfect, trying to figure it all out. And that's a very botched version of a Warren Buffett quote that says, you have all these feelings about the stock, but the stock has no feelings about you. And so when I hear from women about why they haven't started investing yet, and I've had these conversations recently, one with somebody who's so dear and so close to me, who just went through such a brutal divorce, and she said, my husband managed everything. Like, I just don't know where to get started. And I can just picture the overwhelm. It's paralyzing, right? And by the way, still trying to run a business, still trying to pick your kids up from camp, still trying to do this and do that and date and brush your teeth and comb your hair and all the things. It's a lot. I get it. It's intimidating. There's a lot of information, and a lot of that information has been gatekept from us, especially from women. A lot of the financial information has been packaged in these very confusing terms and all of these different options and markets and things and that. I'm here to break it down. That is my 1000% my mission with Old Money Podcast, is to say, look at the way that all of these other families have built wealth. Look at all of the other ways these people have passed on their money from generation to generation. You can do it too, but you do have to get started. So if you feel those perfectionist tendencies popping up, if you feel that fear popping up, if you feel that need for control, I see you. In Old Money Mindset, I help you clear all of that once and for all. And I invite you to step into the next level and the next evolution of really getting wealthy, which is putting your money to work. Now, I have to pause and take a moment to address what's happened this last weekend, which is this crazy Powerball jackpot. And somebody did win it. Well, two people did win it, actually. There was a $1.8 billion Powerball jackpot, the second largest prize in U.S. lottery history. And one of them had, oh my gosh, I'm just seeing this in San Francisco Chronicle. One of the tickets was sold in Northern California, so must be somewhere in the Bay Area. Let's see what it says. Oh, this was a $1.6 million ticket in the Bay Area. And the winning numbers were 11, 23, something else. That's what I would have picked, right? We were all ready to win that jackpot this weekend. Well, I didn't buy a ticket because I don't typically participate in the lottery. But I find it to be so interesting. A lot of people say, and I tend to agree, that the lottery is a tax on the poor. The reason that people say this is because, get this, low-income households spend an average of $412 per year on lottery tickets, which is four times more what the highest income households spend. So even high-income households are spending on this at about $100 per year, but low-income households are just looking for their ticket out of poverty. They are looking for something to come and solve all their problems. It's kind of like going and dating and waiting for that sugar daddy to come and wipe away all of your debt and whisk you off to a yacht in Croatia. It ain't that common, okay? In fact, it is a 1 in 300 million chance that you win the lottery and you actually have better chances of getting struck by lightning. And the reason this is such an interesting tax on the poor is because it's gambling. The lottery is gambling. And what's so crazy about this is that it's a state-sponsored gambling program, like DraftKings and Bovada and all these accounts where you can gamble on sports. Like, most of them are illegal in California, yet we allow the lottery to be a legal, not illegal, a legal gambling outlet that benefits the state. Now, about 60% of how people purchase tickets or the money that they purchase tickets with is going back to the prize pot. So number one, you're using money that you've already been taxed on to go and buy a lottery ticket for the chance of winning the money that other people have put into this. And then 40% goes towards schools or infrastructure and stuff like that. So by the way, that's stuff that should be covered by taxes. So they give you this like feel good, like, oh, it's okay to buy a lottery ticket because it goes towards schools. Well, you know what? Maybe if our money was managed better by the state, we wouldn't have to pay extra money into a lottery to also cover schools and infrastructure, which is still underfunded. Don't get me started. So you're using money that you've already been taxed on to buy a chance to win and then giving that money towards services that should be covered by tax. And then if you win, you have to pay taxes on your winnings. Like, make it make sense. It doesn't make any sense. So with this whole lottery thing, it was a crazy coincidence because I saw this reel, or no, it was a TikTok. I saw it on TikTok. I saw this woman on TikTok and she did a good job like looping me in to wanting to watch it. It was like a 3-minute long video. And she comes up and she goes, I just spent $1,500 on a book of lottery scratchers. My husband doesn't know. Let's see if I win. And so immediately I'm like, okay, let's see if she wins. And when I tell you it was a book, you guys, it was like she was flapping them around. She was like, it's a book. I don't know how many were in there, but she had $50 lottery scratchers. And she was sitting there and scratching them off. And then while she's filming herself scratching them off, she's like, oh, this one has 20 bucks. Oh, I won 200 bucks on this one. Her husband comes home. And she goes, honey, I bought lottery scratchers. And she was definitely Southern. I don't know what her name was. She had a little accent. It was cute. And immediately her husband's like giving her that look, like, what are you doing? You bought a whole book. And then she starts to win. And he's like, oh, let me get one. So immediately his tone shifts. Like, he's judging her. He's like, well, you wasted all of our money on $1,500 worth of lottery scratchers. And then they start winning. And then they're scratching them off together. And all in all, after they scratch off the entire book of lottery scratchers, they report that they won a total of $2,500, meaning they made $1,000 profit on buying that book of lottery scratchers. Now, this is not investment advice because according to the woman in the video, she said she's done this before and this is not typical. I get her strategy because if you think about it, if you're pulling like one lottery scratcher from section one, one lottery scratcher from section two, you're kind of like spreading your chances out. But if you buy a whole book of lottery scratchers, you're more likely to have some more winners if you buy one type. Does that make sense? I also went to, or no, I didn't go to college with her, but she was in my alumni group. And I met this girl once who her job was, she worked for California State Lottery, and her job was to monitor the statistics of all of those machines, those big orange California lottery machines and then make sure that people didn't win too much on them. So she had all these statistics about which ones paid out, because people that really do these scratchy lottery things, they pay attention to their favorite brands of scratchers or their favorite gas stations where they think they win more. And maybe they're superstitious, maybe it's anecdotal, whatever. But her whole job was to make sure that people didn't win too much. So she would move things around and she would say, oh, also this gas station's a low performer, so she'd put some winners in there. Like, we're playing against the house, you guys. The house always wins. And it's just so interesting with all of the talk and people on social media talking about what they'd want to do with the money if they won, and all of the excitement and energy, and everybody's waiting on bated breath to see if they're going to win that Powerball or if they're going to win off that scratcher. And the same day that I watched the woman win $1,000 off that lottery scratcher, $1,000 of profit, in every single one of my investment accounts, I made $1,000 of growth in every single one of them. And I have like seven in one day. Every single thing grew. And every single thing, I set it up months ago, years ago, it's automatically funded. I don't touch it. I don't do anything. I don't have to hope to win. I don't have to go to the gas station and buy a book of lottery scratchers. I don't have to sit there and scratch them all off. I just have to know that some days you win and some days you lose. But overall, when you play the stock market, historically, you are not playing against the house. You are playing with America. You are becoming a part of the biggest companies in the world and participating in their growth. It is so different than gambling. Now, it's not dissimilar from the fact that it's risky, but investing is not gambling if it's done responsibly. And this, my friends, is the first of the seven magnificent myths about investing and why investing is better than the lottery. And why seven myths, you ask? Well, it's to honor the Magnificent Seven, which are the largest seven companies in the S&P 500, and together they make up over 25% of the S&P 500's market value. Their performance honestly influences the entire stock market's direction. Right now, they're all tech companies, and they are Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Nvidia, Meta, and Tesla. Now, I'm sure you've heard of those companies before, no? And I'm sure that you think of these companies as absolute powerhouses of the US economy, as you should. Now, compare that to the seven biggest casinos in Las Vegas, the Encore, the Wynn, the Fountain Blue, Resorts World, whatever it is that you think, it's a totally different ballgame. When you think about the longevity of these companies, the assets of these companies, the market cap of these companies, the value of these companies, how much business they do every single year, wouldn't you want to be a part of that with them? Well, that's what buying stocks is all about. A lot of people think that investing is just gambling and the stock market is the same as betting. But gambling is chance-based. When you show up to a craps table and you say, I'm trying to roll an eight, or you go to roulette and you say, put it all on black, you are relying on something totally random, the roulette table or the dice, to determine whether you win or lose. Now, I'm not a big gambler. Surprise, surprise. I'm pretty conservative with my money, but I'd like you to tell me, like, please write to me and let me know if you know anybody who makes 10% back on their money every time they go to Vegas, because that person is a lucky charm and they should be studied. But if you look back over the history of the S&P 500, which is almost 100 years, it was started in 1926, it has returned 10 to 11% per year on average over time. And that's a big thing, over time. Adjusted for inflation, the real return is closer to 7% per year, which is why you hear that 7% number so commonly. I will use it a lot in my example because it's just one of those common things. We always usually say 7% returns when we're making assumptions about how much we think we can expect to return. But the reality is that there's no gambling when you have 100 years of data over time to show growth. And to take this away from the numbers, let's just think about America as a country. Like, do you have faith that Apple, Amazon, Google, Tesla will continue to grow over time? Or do you think America is going to throw in the hat, shut it all down, say, we give up, everything sucks, everything's on fire, no more innovation, no more ingenuity. Oh, let's let AI take it all over. We're just going to shut it all down. Y'all, good luck. You think the Magnificent Seven are going to stop creating chips and stop creating computers? Absolutely not. So regardless of what you think of the current administration or the current state of your paycheck or how much you're getting paid at your job, if you have faith in the country of the United States of America to continue to grow, then you're in a pretty good position to want to invest in the seven biggest companies of our country. I'm going to tell you something that blew my mind, because every time I get back from Europe, I'm like, oh my God, Europe, they figured it out. They know how to live. What's going on? I don't know why we're doing things so backwards here. Well, crazy stat just came out about Germany and Mississippi. And yes, Germany and Mississippi have something in common. I can't think of two more different economies or types of people. But Mississippi is one of the smallest US state economies. It's only ahead of like Vermont and Wyoming, and they just aren't big because there's nobody that lives there. But Mississippi and Germany have the same GDP per capita. Now, what does this mean? GDP means gross domestic product. Per capita means per person. So Mississippi is the tiniest little state with 3 million people. Its economy is worth $153 billion. Germany is a huge powerhouse country with 84 million people. They make a ton of stuff like cars and beer and all the things. But if you divide the money by the number of people, a person in Mississippi makes about the same as a person in Germany. Now, I don't mean makes the same, like the same income, but the same amount of economic impact. And like, I don't know what they're doing in Mississippi. I don't know anybody in Mississippi. If you are from Mississippi and you live there, can you please write to me on Instagram and tell me what you do for a job? What is the industry there? I have no idea. I could probably Google it, but just that fact alone gives me a lot of faith in the United States, because the United States is like a giant team where even the small players are as strong as the best players, because we have the benefit of all being, you know, united together, i.e. the United States of America. So if you think about these things logically and you think about the way that you think the country is going over time, I mean, maybe some of you do think doom and gloom that it's all going to be lit on fire, or it's going to be like the day after tomorrow and somebody's going to like be sending in a picture of the Statue of Liberty on fire. And then you can tell me, Amber, I told you so. But I am of the camp that I think things are going to keep growing. And I know that investing is not gambling, because I'm not relying on chance. I'm relying on historical data and common sense to know the way that our country is built and the way that these magnificent seven companies are going to continue to grow, plus all the other tiny companies that are going to benefit from being in America. I believe, and this is not investment advice, that I have a pretty good chance of continuing to win if I invest in this country's businesses. So kudos to me for that absolutely beautiful segue between the richest man in Babylon and the women in investing conversation we had with Mira, and then the scratchy lottery girl, all the way into the Powerball and to the first biggest myth that investing is not gambling and why you shouldn't be counting on the Powerball to get rich, but instead consider getting started with investing. This is going to be the thing to give you the mindset momentum to continue forward or to get started. We're going to get into the tacticals, that's for sure. But let's go for now into the very next myth, which is that you have to be a financial genius to invest in the stock market. Or said another way, that you have to figure out what stocks to pick, or you have to watch CNBC and crunch numbers all day. You have to understand spreadsheets. You have to know what you're doing. Listen, you have to, as I always like to say in my business, know enough to be dangerous, but you do not have to be a master financial wizard or a mathematician like Matt Damon and Good Will Hunting to figure out how to use the stock market to your benefit. I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm going to blow up my spot a little bit, okay? So when I was a kid, my dad helped me invest when I was very young, and I always felt really proud of that. Oh, like I'm in the third grade. Yeah, I have an investment. I have investments. I'm so cool. And I had investments in Disney. I'm going to blow up my spot here, okay? Disney was my drug of choice. And no, I am not a Disney adult. Haven't been to Disneyland in a very long time. No shade to the Disney adults out there. But I used to think as a kid that Disney would be like bumping forever. Like, have you ever seen The Little Mermaid? I've never seen a better piece of media. Like, everything's always going to crank Disneyland. Everything's going to crank for cartoons like Moana, Frozen. Well, as you probably know, Disney has struggled in recent years, like pretty badly. And that initial investment that I had all those years ago, while it performed pretty well for a time, it started to trickle off. But even worse than the fact that it trickled off, if the money that I had invested in Disney would have been invested into a index fund or an ETF, which is an electronically traded fund, I would have been so much better off. Let me tell you why. Let's make up a scenario. It's me. I'm 3 years old. It's 1990. I've got $5,000 in my pocket. I am a ballin' little boss baby. I am ready to spend my money and invest it because I'm also brilliant. But me in 1990, I'm like, Jungle Book rocks. Let's go with that. I put my $5,000 into the company I think that's going to be the best forever, Disney. If I had that money invested in Disney from 1990 until today in 2025, it would be worth $88,700. Like, that's a huge return on that five grand, right? 17 times more than I had invested in 1990. That's pretty impressive. But if I would have invested $5,000 into an S&P 500 index fund, it would have returned for me 37 times my original investment of $187,600. So I'm talking about a full $100,000 more I would have gotten from investing into an index fund in 1990 that represented the S&P 500 versus me thinking I am a brilliant boss baby and investing in Disney stock. Why is this? Because the S&P 500 is made up of 500 companies that are weighted based on their market cap. So it's the 500 top companies in the United States. And what happens over time is that if you become 501, you get kicked out and they bring in the new 500 person. So the S&P 500 is automatically going to always have the top 500 companies that are performing well. They don't have any dogs. If you go out of business, you get kicked out. The other thing is that it's, you know, spreading around the risk. It's diversifying. By spreading out your investment over 500 different companies, you're going to say, listen, I know not all of these are going to take off. I know that some of them are going to be hit by drama or conflict or bad news cycles or economics or whatever. And you know what? That happens to all companies. It happens to every company, even the Magnificent Seven. Like, there's been drama with Tesla. There's been drama with Mark Zuckerberg. There's been drama with Nvidia. There's drama with everything all the time. But the reality is that if you bet on something that gets fully canceled, you might lose all of your money. But when you make a bet on something that has 500 players, okay, one of them can get canceled, one of them can go bankrupt, and at the end of the day, the other 499 are going to pull their weight. It's kind of like looking at New York and California and looking at Mississippi. Like, Mississippi has the benefit of being in the equivalent of the S&P 500, which is the US economy of 50, right? And you're going to be bolstered up and supported by the infrastructure and the success of all of the other people in your network. And that's why we want to diversify. But the diversification in choosing an index fund to spread risk and reliably capture market growth without feeling like you're guessing, that's just one piece of it. I know a lot of women out there are thinking like, I don't even know where to get started. And an index fund is one thing that I just beg you to go talk to ChatGPT about. But that fear of not knowing what you're doing, don't let that perfectionist piece or that need for control or predictability run your financial show. There is so much evidence and so much support, including from me, to let you know that you are supported in taking small steps forward. You just have to start to take one. So if you were going to start your investment journey, my recommendation for you would be to first find a reputable brokerage to start working with. A brokerage is kind of like a bank. So that might be like Charles Schwab or Vanguard or Fidelity. I recommend those three because they're easy to use, they are absolutely credible, and they offer a lot of options to invest in index funds. In fact, index funds were invented by the founder of Vanguard, Jack Bogle. So if you want to say thanks, Jack, go to Vanguard. The reason I like Vanguard and Fidelity especially is because the index funds that they offer through that brokerage are very low cost. So yes, there's a lot of things to know. What's in it? What's the right one? There's so many to choose from. We're going to get to that, I totally promise you, but the reality is get started by opening an investment account at one of those three institutions and then researching and looking for index funds as your first way to go. Now, I know what you're going to say, and it's myth number three. You're going to tell me, but Amber, I just don't have enough money. I should just wait until I make more money. And you know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like I'll start my business when I get that bonus and then I can finally leave, or I'll start going on dates when I lose that 15 pounds, or I don't know, I'll start being nice to my kids when they start being perfect angels. Whatever criteria you set for yourself is going to get in the way of you having what it is you really, really want. If you want to wait until you lose the weight to start dating, are you getting to what you actually want faster, or are you delaying it? Because I think if you're dating, what you actually want is love, connection, intimacy, the opportunity to create a relationship with someone. By waiting to date, are you postponing that dream, or are you living it? Because you have to start going on the dates in order to create the relationship that you want, right? And it's the same thing with investing. You have to start investing if you want to build the wealth that you dream of. And you don't have to wait until you have a big income jump. You don't have to wait until you have all of this extra cash. You just have to get started now. Because the longer you delay, the less time you give your money to compound, the less time you give your money to grow by the virtue of just being in the stock market. Because compounding interest is what really makes the magic happen. It's like the GLP-1 of money, because you literally put it in the market, it injects this shot into your money, and your money starts growing based on how much is in the account. And then as you add more money to the account, by it just sitting there and growing, it has even more to grow on top of it. It just keeps snowballing. And the reality is that time in the market, which means how long you leave your investments sitting there and growing, is more important than any other metric. So not only do you need to figure out how to get started as soon as possible so that you can have a longer time in the market, you also don't need a lot to get started. The same way that I've been hyping up America, like, let me hype you up, girl. Like, America's doing better and better and better every year. Like, are you making the same amount that you made at your first job in high school or the first job out of college? No, you have growth potential every single year. So if you continue to follow the richest man in Babylon's advice and keep saving a little bit of your money and setting it aside, you're going to continue to have more and more and more to set aside and more and more and more to grow. So don't wait, because it would suck to wait until you're, I don't know, 50 years old and you're like, oh, I finally got a $50,000 bonus. I'll put that into investments. And you don't already have anything else there. It's little by little by little that everything adds up. So don't wait until you have more money to get started. Just start now with what you can. It's so important to set the habit and to get things in motion. Even if you're just setting aside $20 a week and you have an automatic investment going into an ETF, I love that for you. It's super powerful to get started no matter where you are. The next myth that I hear all the time is that the stock market is rigged against small investors. A lot of people think that only Wall Street insiders win. And I'm not saying that that's not untrue. Wall Street insiders do win. If we look at like Nancy Pelosi's returns over the course of the last however long she's been in government, her returns far outperform just the regular market. She far outperforms any hedge fund manager or small investor, but not only Wall Street insiders win. Also, small investors can win. I'm not saying that it's not rigged by all of these crazy people in government or the way that certain people outperform. And certainly, you do earn more if you're investing more, but that doesn't mean that everyday investors can't win too. You can absolutely continue to win if you're investing in broad, low-cost index funds. And to be honest with you, a lot of those index funds outperform mutual funds. Mutual funds are managed by people. Those are managed by financial managers. And it's kind of like betting that a human is going to be more accurate than a machine or a robot. Because an electronically traded fund is one that's managed by an algorithm. It's managed by math. And certainly that math was developed by a person. But at the end of the day, I've told this story before, I had an ex-boyfriend one time get a job at an investing firm and then hit me up for investments. And I was like, oh, no, honey, there's no way that I'm going to hand my money over to you. That's every finance bro, okay? We've all dated them. We know them. They are looking adorable in their tech vest, but I'm not handing my money over to some guy and trusting him more than I trust myself or trust a computer or trust history. Because again, Wall Street insiders that have insider trading secrets, those are illegal, by the way, are going to do well because they know the moves to make. But that doesn't mean that we're playing blind. We have history on our side. We have index fund research on our side. We absolutely have ways to continue to win even if we don't have those insider trading secrets. Myth number five is that saving money is just safer. Honestly, savings accounts do not protect your wealth best because inflation eats away at cash. Now, we have been living in the age of inflation. Remember when eggs were like $15 a year ago? Now they're like 10. It hasn't gotten much better. But the reality is that investing is what actually builds purchasing power over time. And like I mentioned earlier, historically, the returns on the S&P 500 have been between 10 and 11% per year, which is so great, by the way. Imagine if you had $1 million in the bank and you got a free $100,000 a year for not doing anything, right? If you are just having your $1 million in the bank, it's just not going to get an extra $100,000 for free. So if you just leave your money in a savings account, it's not going to grow for you. And the reality is that inflation is climbing every single year. And when we look at it over the long term, again, we're looking at like 3 to 4% inflation, which is why we adjust that rate of return down to 7%. Does that make sense? Because if your money is losing its value by 3 to 4% per year, but your portfolio is growing 10 to 11% per year, that means that if we minus out the inflation, on average, it's going to grow about 7% per year. So it might feel safer because you've been indoctrinated with these thoughts and these beliefs that investing your money is risky, or the stock market is risky, or you can lose all your money. I'm not saying those things aren't true. I'm just saying that there's ways to hedge against those fears. So I'll give you a really good example. If you remember the 2008 market crash, I remember exactly where I was the day it all hit the fan. I was getting my nails done in La Jolla, and an old man was outside waiting for his wife. I'm like older, like retirement age. And in the middle of her pedicure, he came in from outside. He was on the phone. He's like, "We need to go now. The market is down bad." And that shook me to my core. And I will never forget that moment because I just remember the fear in his voice. And again, I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something around the market. He just got off the phone with somebody. They needed to leave. Like, she left before her pedicure was even done because they were so freaked out. But we're all, for the most part, relatively young. Like, I'm looking at the listener survey. I see how old we are. We have a lot of time. So even if the market corrects or the market crashes, which are just different ways to describe how much the market goes up or down by, we still have time to recover. Because remember when I said that 7% or that 10 to 11% that the S&P 500 grows every single year? That's historically on average over time. So yeah, some years it did lose money. Some years it gained more than 10%. So it averages out to that 10 to 11%. And as you get closer to retirement age, when you get more sophisticated and you start to get help from financial advisors or wealth managers, you're going to balance your portfolio differently so that you don't open yourself up to as much risk. There's not the same game that you play from day one in investing to day 100 in investing. It evolves over time depending on where you are in your life. So if you think that being in a savings account is safer than being in the stock market, you probably think that because you have a connotation of fear and of loss and of risk. And that's not the right story. That is fear-based. That is money story. That is an unhealthy money story. And a lot of us carry that around with us. I know a lot of us do because of the way that our parents thought about money or the way that they viewed wealthy people or investments in general. I know one of my friends that I had in college, her grandfather owned a whole bunch of parking lots in San Diego. And he was a Holocaust survivor. And he had a lot of trauma around money and survival. And he was afraid of the banks. He thought the banks were going to steal all of his money for him. So he saved all of his money in shoeboxes. And she said that his rooms and his homes were lined with shoeboxes full of cash, just like rows upon rows upon rows of that. And you want to know who I thought of first during the Altadena fires? Was her grandfather. Could you imagine having shoeboxes full of cash go up in flames because of a freak once-in-a-generation fire and you lose all of your wealth? I mean, that's a physical example of your wealth going up in flames, but the reality is, even if you are not putting your money to work for you, you're losing out on so much growth and so much opportunity just by getting into the game. Like, we want to win this game of wealth, yet so many of us are afraid to step on the board because a lot of us feel like we don't know the rules. And that's what I'm here for. I want to help bust these myths for you and help you feel so, so comfortable so that you can start playing the game. Now, myth number six is an interesting one. A lot of people think that their money's going to be locked up if they invest it. And there are a lot of different ways that you can invest your money. The way that we're talking about here is really just general investing, like through a brokerage account. If you have retirement investing, whether it's through a 401k or a traditional or Roth IRA, there might be penalties for you to withdraw that money prior to your retirement age. And the reason for that is because you're getting hooked up with some good terms in those 401ks or Roth or traditional IRAs around taxes. And so if you pull it out early, they're like, hey, we thought you were going to leave your money there till you're 65. You got to pay us extra if you want it out now. So I think that's where that myth comes from. And also we think of things like certificates of deposits, also known as CDs, where you invest your money, so to speak, in an investment vehicle for a certain amount of time, and you're not supposed to take it out until the time matures. But if you have a brokerage account, you can choose a liquid investment like an index fund or even stocks. You can sell those anytime. Retirement accounts are optional. They're not mandatory. They should definitely be the basis of your beginning to invest because you want to invest long-term. But when you have a brokerage account, you can buy and sell stocks all the time. Your money isn't tied up. Now, do I recommend that you do that? Actually, probably not. I still think short-term investing should be held for a reasonable amount of time because you're going to have massive tax implications. This is something that day traders or people that are interested in day trading or swing trading don't take into consideration enough, and they get shocked because at the end of the year, they are hit with super high short-term capital gains taxes. That is if you have and hold an investment and sell it within 365 days, within 1 year. If you buy an asset and sell it and you've had it for less than a year, the profit that you made on that investment is considered a short-term capital gain, which is taxed at ordinary income or your regular federal income tax bracket, which would be between, 22 and 37%. So depending on your overall income, that's how it's going to be taxed. if you have a long-term hold, meaning you hold an asset for more than a year, your profit's considered a long-term capital gain. And so depending on your income, the rates can be between 0 and 20%. It's a more favorable rate. The lower tax rate is designed to encourage you to hold it for longer and have more long-term investing, which is generally considered beneficial for the broader market. Day trading isn't the best. Day trading, in my opinion, is the equivalent of gambling because you're just hoping for quick action and quick hits, and you're going in and making trades every single day. That's a full-time job. Swing trading is where you make an investment and you hold it for maybe a few days or a few weeks or a few months. You're still active in the market, but you are making decisions to make profit relatively quickly. That is going to be taxed as short-term capital gains. But my investment strategy, personally, this is not investment advice, is always long-term. Whether it's I'm investing for a house or I'm investing for my retirement or I'm just investing to see my net worth grow, it's just about having money that's being put to work that's part of my wealth. It's not stuff that I'm using to fund my lifestyle. It's something that I'm building as an asset that I want to grow on its own. And the true answer to financial freedom is when the assets you own are producing enough money to live off of so that you don't have to work. That might be a trust fund, right? Maybe you have a trust fund that's so big that the interest on it every single month pays you $50,000 in mailbox money, and that's what you use to live. Or maybe you have multiple rental properties and those rental properties cash flow, meaning that you get money every single month from those rental properties because the people paying rent on them, it's covering the mortgage, the taxes, the insurance, all of the maintenance, and then you have money left over every single month. And you have so many of those that you're living off of that cash flow income. Or maybe you've had those rental properties for so long that the mortgages are paid off and the maintenance is very little. And so everything they're paying in rent, you just have as cash flow. Or maybe you're investing in businesses and those businesses pay you returns on a quarterly or annual basis. And those returns are enough for you to not have to work every single day and the investments are working for you. That's when you escape the hustle, escape the matrix, escape the 9 to 5, you stop trading your time for money and you start letting your assets build your wealth for you. So if you think, I don't want my money locked up, you can absolutely choose liquid investments that you can sell anytime. Probably won't want to based on tax rates, or maybe if you think about this with real estate, maybe the market's not the right time to sell. Whatever the criteria might be, there's a million different scenarios out there. The reality is most of the brokerage accounts or short-term investing, long-term investing that I'm talking about, your money will be liquid, meaning that you can get it when you need it, if you want it. Watch out though for retirement accounts where you might be penalized for withdrawing it. Okay, and the last myth that I want to bust that I think is so important is that I'm too old to start investing. Now, I even get in my head about this and I think, oh my God, why was I so dumb to have that Disney stock and not have an S&P 500 index fund? I am so dumb. I should have started investing when I was 5. The best time to buy real estate was when I was 11. I missed out. And it's really easy to beat yourself up and raise your hand if you've ever done that before. There is a super cliche quote that says, the best time to plant a tree was 10 years ago. The second best time is today. The same thing goes with investing. You can start your journey at any time, but if you don't get started, you'll never be on the path. It's the same thing with starting a business or finding a relationship or adopting a dog. If you want to adopt a dog, you have to start going to the Humane Society, no matter how much you cry when you go. Like, you have to start the process or else you'll never have a dog. So even if it feels uncomfortable, even if you feel out of your depth, even if it's something that scares you, there are resources out there, I am one of them, to help build your confidence, to tell you that anybody can do this and everybody should. You have to stop thinking that the Powerball is going to come and save you. It's not going to save you. All that you're doing is using your taxed money to pay more taxes and then have to get taxed in case you do win, which you have a better chance of getting struck by lightning or dying in an airplane crash. And sorry to go all doom and gloom, but like, it's not the ticket. And the reality is even if you buy a pack of lottery scratchers for $1,000 and one time you make $1,000 in profit, I can guarantee that of all of the times this woman has ever bought a scratchy lottery ticket at a gas station over the course of her lifetime, overall, she's a loser as it relates to the profit. That one time that's highlighted on that one TikTok got her 1 million views or whatever it did, good for her, but that's not a long-term investment strategy. Your long-term investment strategy starts with opening your brokerage account, researching some index funds, and starting some automatic investments so that you can build on your future no matter where you are today. These are just 7 myths that I think get in the way of women investing, and I don't want anything to get in your way ever. So if you are interested in getting help in building your money machine, I am here to help you. And I am here to remind you that you deserve it. Being wealthy is not a pipe dream and it's not a lottery ticket. It takes strategy, it takes time, and it takes confidence. So I hope that in this exploration of the 7 magnificent myths about investing, that you feel a little bit more qualified to take the first step. And we're going to continue to take these steps together. I'm here for you. I love you so much. Let's get rich, baby. I'll talk to you guys on the next episode. Don't forget to fill out the Old Money Listener Survey. The links are in the show notes. Take a shot. And also remember, this is not investment advice. Take a shot. Or better yet, pour yourself a glass of wine. Love you so much. And I'll talk to you guys on the next episode. Bye. Look at you investing in your rich life one episode at a time. You're not just listening, you're leveling up. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, or prayers, slide into my inbox at oldmoneypodcast@gmail.com or in my DMs on Instagram at oldmoneypodcast. If this episode made you laugh, think, or write down a single note, please do me a solid and rate, review, and subscribe. It takes less time than your morning scroll and it helps this show reach more future millionaires. And speaking of growing the network, please share this with your ambitious bestie, your business buddy, or your secretly rich aunt. Please share the gospel of old money, and I will be more grateful than a trust fund kid on distribution day. Thank you for being here. I'm rooting for your bank account, and I will catch you on the next episode of Old Money. Remember, I am not your lawyer, I am not your tax professional, and I am not your financial advisor. The content presented in this podcast is intended to entertain, educate, inspire, and support listeners and their personal and professional development and does not constitute business, financial, or legal advice.